we go. Oh, baby, welcome to Duck It Motherfucking Dialogue.
Oh, man, that was pretty good.
Going hard here. All right, we're recording. I'm here with Jesse Ware and Mike Brewer. How do you say it? How am I saying it?
In Austrian, it's Vaya.
Vaya, okay.
Vaya.
So
loosely it translates to wire, I guess.
Okay, and that's W-E-Y-H-E-R.
Very good.
Boom, baby. I can spell. I got Mike Brewer here, two skydivers that they're here in Arizona right now doing a little jump in. So we're going to talk to them today, see what they're all about, see what they're doing. Yeah, good to see you guys. You can follow him on Instagram at Jesse. That's J-E-S-S-E-W-E-Y-H-E-R.
Nice one.
And then Mike Brewer.
Mike triple underscore Brewer.
Oh, is that on Instagram? Oh, I didn't know you had. You couldn't get the number one?
Yeah, apparently.
The OG
first
one?
Two underscores were taken.
You should have a talk with this guy. I'm going to look him up right now.
Look him up, and then we need to spam him.
That's a good idea.
So he can give it back to you.
Thanks.
Cool. So you guys are out here just doing some jumping. I don't know. I want to kind of talk about your journey a little bit and the, you know, the skydiving sport. We had all kind of started at the same time, and then you guys drastically improved and progressed. And I had a family.
Yeah, and look who's coming out on top. Sounds cool.
Not to digress at all, but Mike Brewer with a blue check mark next to his name has 231,000 followers, is an artist, a TV host.
Oh, shit, bro.
A Ford owner. And yeah, fat chance, Mike.
Well, he's a Ford owner.
Sounds like I already won.
Oh, that's funny.
All right, Mike, go for it.
Yeah,
skydiving. Well, I mean, I can't speak for anybody else. Skydiving's different for everybody, but getting into the sport for me was just, you know, something that kind of filled a hole that was missing in my life at the time. And, you know, I found a really good group of people and something to be passionate about. And it kind of consumed me after that. And I spent basically all my time and money learning how to fall really effectively in wind.
What made you do that first jump, or did you do a tandem first? How did you get into it?
Yeah, so I was going to the Citadel, which is a military college in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And I was pretty miserable there. And an old friend, Megan Carey, had promised me that we'd go skydiving a few years earlier, but I was too young to go. So she came back into town and called me on that promise, and I ended up going, and they gave us the option. You can either jump with someone or you can jump on by yourself. And, you know, you have to take a couple hour course more, and it's like a little more expensive. And I was like, well, you know, if I'm only going to do this once, I want to do it by myself, which now knowing what I know, it's a really stupid reason. But I'm really glad I did, because it's what allowed me to stay in the sport. And it's actually where I met Jesse Wire on that first day when I walked in to do my first jump course. He was one of the other students.
So was that at Walterboro, your first jump?
Yeah.
Okay.
And a couple hour course is a really loose estimate. I think it was like an hour and a half, maybe.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't very long. It was very Fandango-ish. Yeah. Seen that scene from that movie with Kevin Costner.
Lunch break included. Yeah. An hour and a half.
Yeah, our instructor was taking cigarette breaks and chilling and being super laxadaisable, which in hindsight, I think encouraged us to take kind of a similar attitude and being relaxed in the more elementary years of our progression. He kind of had a fun-loving attitude towards it, and I can't speak for Mike, but for me that really struck me and encouraged me to keep going, because it didn't have to be this super intense process.
Yeah.
Even though we're in this rest in peace guy of Walterboro, this sort of for lack of better words, modest drop zone.
Yeah. Yeah,
that was a little disconcerting for maybe the untrained eye.
Yeah. Very polite way.
Yeah.
It was a really nice place for the 70s.
Yeah, I mean that's where I got my my start too, and started jumping there, and that's where I met you guys. And then you got, so when you started jumping there, you did your course, then you became coaches, or what did you do from there?
Well, we took separate paths for a little bit. I'll let you go ahead, Jesse.
became coaches. We watched a PowerPoint, gave a guy some money, and suddenly we're qualified to jump with people who are candidates to get their skydiving license. We can't touch them in free fall, so if they spin out of control, there's nothing you can do with this new health rating. But you got a free jump, and to us, that was really exciting at the time. So we both did that for a while, and I don't know where we didn't really veer off, I guess. We kind of went the same way for a while.
Yeah, well,
you guys went to Rayford, didn't you?
Well, there's a lot of stuff in between. You stayed in Walterboro for a while, yeah? Or I can't remember. I ended up going up north to Wilmington because I transferred out of the Citadel.
Right, I forgot that detail.
That I wanted a better life for myself and a more suited life. There's nothing wrong with joining the military. I wanted a little bit more freedom out of my years.
Yes, yeah.
Those years. And I ended up at this kind of crap drop zone up north. Really pretty drop zone, like epic views of the ocean, like 270 degrees of water, but not really any room for advancement. And then this new drop zone opened up, and they're hungry and looking for fresh young blood, fresh impressionable skydivers. Yeah,
I forgot about that.
Didn't know any better and would do work for free.
Yeah, so skydive Myrtle Beach is where me and Jesse ended up together again, working at this drop zone, which was, I could write a book about that place.
I forgot about that. I remember all that going down.
It was a pretty wild couple of years. So I was down at the College of Charleston, in Charleston, South Carolina, commuting to Walterboro on the weekends and having house parties back at my house and waking up early and going jumping and stuff like that. Total bro sort of lifestyle.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were house parties, though.
Yeah, they were for sure. And all the instructors would come, these 40-year-old guys come to these house parties. It's really funny.
College girls everywhere. 40-year-old broken dudes.
Yeah, it was pretty good times. But so then I started commuting up to Myrtle Beach where Mike commuted down to, and we would sleep in this hot and humid hangar and these 80, 90 degree nights and sleep like under the wings of the aircraft so the birds wouldn't shit on us, and we would just party in this hangar and get up and do, these work jumps that we probably weren't prepared for at the time.
Definitely weren't prepared for. I'm going to leave it at that, take the fifth there, but
yeah,
plead the fifth.
Yeah, we kind of ended up having to figure it out. We were, thrown to the wolves a little bit.
Yeah.
I think, actually played a pretty pivotal role, at least in my progression. I can't speak for Jesse, but being forced to learn how to do everything on your own and be responsible for your own jumps instead of having someone kind of shepherd you all the way made me a more independent and proficient skydiver after having survived it. It was definitely not the right way to do it. But once, I kind of beat the learning curve, I found, that I knew a lot of things and I could pass them on to people.
Yeah, well said. Shout out to Greg Windmiller from the Golden Knights, former thereof, for teaching me how to do tandems a couple years into me doing tandems.
A couple years of you.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. That's funny. Okay, so the skydive Myrtle Beach went kaput for y'all.
It went kaput for everybody. They had a massive turf war with the corrupt government of North Myrtle Beach and basically... sank all of their money into legal fees, got kicked off the airport, and fought that battle for a few years, but kind of just withered into oblivion.
Wow. Yeah, man. So they just must have had some sort of vendetta against that guy, huh?
Or what? I think it went both ways.
Yeah.
I think if you come into a good old boy system and then decide to be a bully, it doesn't work very well.
Yeah.
The ownership wasn't necessarily wrong. They were doing a lot of things wrong, maybe, but they weren't necessarily wrong in their ability to access the airport, and they didn't make their life any easier by the way they treated the local government. Yeah, the powers that be.
Gotcha.
And they definitely didn't like us going shirtless into the main building of the drop zone to take a shower while these vacationers are coming to do helicopter tours and stuff and see these naked 20-year-old dudes running around.
It was also a pretty popular airport for when high class people wanted to come into Myrtle Beach for whatever reason. I have no idea why anyone would ever want to go back there. They would fly these big Citation jets in there, tons of money, and then, like Jesse said, just hippies trying to find a place to shower and eating the free popcorn out of the FBO. Yeah.
It's like, oh, we need to get these guys out of here.
They want you can't fight City Hall.
Yeah. And honestly, it was the best thing that happened to my skydiving career.
Did you guys go different ways from there? Or?
Not really. I remember when I left, I flew. I drove down the coast to my friend Bob Crossman's house. I don't know if you remember him from Skydive to Land. And he was living in Charleston for a moment. And I remember being really upset and venting to him that, you know, my whole world was crashing because this place was crashing down. And he, in his Bob way, gave me a lot of insight as to why, you know, your life is just beginning and the universe has all these, you know, whatever things for you. And pretty much at the same time, I think Mike and I both started flying the vertical indoor skydiving wind tunnel in Rayford, North Carolina. I think within months of each other, right?
Yeah. Probably. Yeah, so there's this thing called a membership there. And it basically only exists in that specific wind tunnel in Rayford, which is pretty much propped up by, you know, doing, like, training military skydivers, so they can afford to have members of the community fly for cheaper through a membership. So, you know, when I say cheaper, it's a relative term. Like, we both paid basically a mortgage for a year to fly in that wind tunnel.
Okay.
That's a good way of putting it.
But
while living in tents.
Yeah, we were living in tents. And
but would you have been able to progress the way you did if you hadn't done that way? So
it was a huge turning point in both of our careers. Like, that drop zone, you know, for all of its weirdness and faults, is a total, like, it's a machine that just pumps out talent and skill because of the things it has available. It has a massive training facility for skydiving with all the amenities and a huge fleet of airplanes that they use frequently. And then the wind tunnel is basically the best training tool that anyone could ever have made for this sport. I equate it now to, like, the wave pools in surfing, you know, like real waves where surfers can just hit the same wave over and over and over and over again until they get a skill. I mean, if it hasn't already, surfing is about to progress like it hasn't progressed ever in history. It's going to go through a renaissance. So that's basically what the wind tunnel did.
Gotcha.
And that's why we were willing to pay a mortgage to live there and fly there every day.
Yeah.
I equate it to, like, a socially acceptable steroids for skydivers.
Yeah.
By the way, we're throwing a lot of loose terms around. If you want us to explain what we're talking about when we say wind tunnel or drop zone and want us to elaborate.
Okay, yeah, that's true. I guess we might have some people who aren't familiar with some of the terms. But, yeah, so, like, a wind tunnel, it's just a big tunnel with a fan on the bottom that simulates some sort of skydiving in a sense.
It's a big magic room that makes dreams come true.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's, just picture a bunch of 500 something horsepower electric fans blowing wind through a recirculating tube. And there's a specific area in that tube where the air pressure gets high enough and it's able to overcome the force of gravity. And you get to fly in it. And, you know, I think maybe the biggest thing missing from this conversation, if people are trying to understand skydiving, is that it's not falling. You, at that speed, are able to use the air to manipulate your body to push yourself all over the place. You can hit speeds of over 100 miles per hour horizontally without even wearing a suit. Like, your body becomes a wing. Granted, it's a wing that, you know, you can't hit the ground with, but it's a wing nonetheless. And so, you know, as you're listening to this and thinking of, like, okay, these people sold their lives to go fall out of airplanes, like, it's important to know that there was a world of physics and fun and, like, new skills that we were unlocking this whole time, and it was super addictive. And
our sacrifice didn't go in vain.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think.
Not yet. We'll find out. Yeah. So, Rayford.
So, what kind of... So, after all that, what opportunities open from there? You went from, because I know you're doing competitions and stuff, you know, you're all over the place, you're all over the world. Like, how did you guys get, I mean, you're sponsored, you were in Parachutist, Mike, right?
Yeah,
you had an article in there. And so how, from, I guess, you know, all your time in the wind tunnel, when did opportunities start presenting themselves to where you're either making money doing this, or...
Well, I don't think it's just the wind tunnel. I mean, Rayford, especially where the skydiving center is that we're referencing, is basically an aggregate for a lot of different walks of life in the skydiving community as far as different disciplines go. So there's a lot of world champions in freefall disciplines and in flying fast parachute disciplines, which is what I really like to do. And there's basically a world champion sitting next to you in the bar every night or on your plane. So if you're in this environment, you can tap into these resources in a friendly way and make friends with these people. They have a lot to share and they want to share it with you. Mm. So being porous and being really absorbent to just taking all this information was invaluable for me, and it helped me a lot in getting started in competing and stuff. I think Mike would agree, because we had a team together in 2015 and we had a lot of mentors who helped us out along the way, and just the mindset of the ending competition, strategy and stuff like that. And from there, when you start sort of climbing the ranks, I guess, a little bit in competition stuff, companies will start to notice you a little more and give you stuff. Unfortunately, there's absolutely no money in skydiving, yeah. But any care packages of free stuff is kind of cool. Makes you feel like a rock star for 2 minutes.
You're like, shit, I gotta pay for stuff still.
Yeah, when you're talking about, you know, like how are we getting paid for things and like living the lifestyle we're living, it's kind of a double edged sword. You know, we're not like other pro athletes where we're paid to compete, because skydiving doesn't have a spectatorship, but what it does have is fanaticism. You know, people are as obsessed with skydiving as we were, and they're willing to go through the same measures that we went through in order to make themselves better. So there's a big opportunity for coaching, one of the things I do is create films for events or within the free fall community. Mm-hmm. Anything like that. Like people will pay you for the value that you present. So companies will give you free gear because you can help them advertise, because people want to fly what the good people are flying.
Or, yeah.
You can coach people because they know that you have the ability to give them a shortcut to get to where you are.
Yeah.
So it's always kind of a hustle, you know, like half of it is like your passion and what you're trying to pursue at the moment, whether it's competition or, you know, like some crazy travel gig or some interesting project, or, you know, like whatever, that's one half of it. And then the other half of it is always that, like, okay, well, how am I going to fund this? And it usually comes back to, one of a few things, like, coaching in any of the different disciplines. Jesse does a lot of canopy piloting, like he was talking about, which is flying these really small, really fast, high performance, parachutes or wings, you know, at the ground, and, competing in these different quantifiable, categories. Or, you know, for what I'm doing, it's a lot of like free flying, which is more free fall oriented. Not that Jesse isn't really, really good at that as well. You got to find a way to, I guess, make yourself valuable. And then you basically, I always say that skydiving is really, you'll never get rich doing it, but you'll never have trouble paying rent. Like, you can make a lot of money really quickly, but then, you know, it goes away really quickly.
Yeah, when you get new shit. And
easy come, easy go.
Yeah, easy come, easy go. So Freddie got fingered.
Can I do a shout out, a little plug real quick?
Yeah, do whatever, man.
So yeah, it's not really a spectator sport. I mean, it's impossible for it to be a spectator sport, right? Like, average person.
Yeah, you can
be in round 6 of nationals and free fall with you. But I recently got invited to this competition platform called Swoop Freestyle, and they do these basically exhibitions all over the world. Last year, the main one was Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, and basically you jump out of a helicopter over this body of water, do tricks over the water, like turn around backwards in the harness, let go of the steering controls, put your hands in the water, whatever, and try to land on a raft. It's subjective with a panel of judges, which is can be frustrating sometimes, or in your favor sometimes, but... these two Danish guys who were really, for lack of better words, obsessed with skydiving, wanted to try to bring this to the mainstream media. So right now they have a distribution through something called Edge TV, and they've been on the Olympic Channel, and they're really trying to make a push to try to get into the mainstream, whether that's possible or not. Not sure. I think it's a really cool idea though, and hopefully, that will spark some more attention towards the community and other disciplines as well.
So Edge TV, is that something you don't, is like an app or is that?
Yeah, it's just you can go on a website, or I think you can get it through Apple TV and whatever the other thing is.
Okay.
Roku.
Roku.
But anyways, yeah, back to Mike.
That was actually, that's a really cool thing to touch on, to be honest. Like, if you've never seen canopy piloting, if you don't watch Tosh.0 a lot, also known as swooping, the sport's really cool, and it happens right in front of you in the same place. You know, like, you could stand 10 feet away and watch these people ripping over water.
Or
like,
crashing.
Or crashing.
Or crashing at over 90 miles per hour horizontal. It's insane.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's the closest thing that skydiving gets to NASCAR, except there's no roll cage around you. You know, like, it's pretty high stakes, and it's really rad to watch. So if you've never seen it, like, and you see one of these swoop freestyle events coming up, then you should go watch it, because it's really, really cool.
Having said that, just to go back to what you were saying about making money in the sport and stuff, and competitor. Audiences, this being digestible for people to watch. Wind tunnel flying has changed the game for skydiving, but also for a lot of, I guess we call them athletes or pilots, I don't know, body pilots. What would you call a wind tunnel flyer? An athlete?
I would say athlete. I mean, you can't see. No normal person can just go in there without any sort of training and do what they're doing in there. So I would say.
I mean, if golfers are athletes,
yeah, that's a very fair point. Let's call them athletes. So this glass tube, anyone can stand around and watch. And there's been a paradigmatic shift in the skill level of a lot of these people, with more and more vertical wind tunnels being constructed around the world. And now people, for lack of a better parallel, have these routines, artistic routines, like imagine a figure skater essentially, and do these beautiful things in these glass tubes, upside down, right side up, doing fast spins, really powerful moves and stuff. And they make a good amount of money doing it.
Okay.
Both in coaching and in prize money all over the world. So it's a pretty cool thing to see coming up over the past 4 or 5 years.
So if they figured out how to get some sort of camera, like a big long lens camera or something, make it so people could spectate that, I think there'd be a lot more.
I think they did in the 90s in the X Games.
Really?
And it just kind of
just didn't work.
I don't think it really caught on.
Yeah, it's just hard for people to understand. Again, skydiving, you know, part of me as like a filmmaker and, you know, someone who's passionate for the sport wants people to understand skydiving so badly.
Yeah.
But then the other part of me knows that, like, until you've done it, it's pretty impossible to not just understand why people want to do it, but also just like what is actually happening.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think the wind tunnel is cool because these new artistic routines are starting to merge. You know, it's like a mix between really powerful gymnastics and snowboarding and stuff, and then like, you know, dance or figure skating, which, you know, depending on how you're, like, what you're into, like, there's a little bit of something for everyone. So you can kind of go into one of these buildings where they're holding an event, and there will be a crowd of like hundreds of people in there and watching it if it's a big competition, and it's really cool.
That's cool. Yeah.
You might also see some crashes in that environment as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
It hurts pretty bad. My fair share. But yeah, these events are happening everywhere. Tunnels are popping up everywhere. I got to travel to all over the country in America, and then to Bahrain for the World Cup in 2018, and then to Lille, France for the World Championships in 2019. And, you know, those are two places that I never really thought that I was going to end up going.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, that's part of the, it's the rad part of the journey, right? Like,
so is the tunnel taking you more places than just, you know, jumping in general, or would you say it's kind of a mix between the two?
You know, I'd say at this point I'm kind of trying to figure out where I want to go now and then figure out how to get there.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, before I was kind of getting led around by work, and it's a pretty miserable way to travel. Like, kind of see the same thing every time you go. You're only scheduled your travel for like when you're there to do the work. So you'll either see a lot of different airports or you'll see a lot of different wind tunnels. But I'm starting to appreciate the value in going somewhere just to go there. And then if I can find a way to book a gig somewhere in the middle of the trip, then, you know, and I can, you know, develop the time in the free time to make that trip happen, then that's kind of where it's at in my mind.
Gotcha. And then you've been doing some skiing crazy nonsense. I don't even know what that's even called. Like,
ski shooting. Yeah, that's just an extracurricular thing that I'm liking in the winter now, rather than being in the States during the winter when there's not much skydiving work. For the past 2 years, I've been in Valfréjus, France, which is in the Alps.
Yeah, okay.
And basically you have these high-performance wings, very similar to skydiving wings, but really efficient. And you can ski with them. And if you kind of pull on the stoppy stringy things, you can leave the snow and fly. Yeah. And you can do really radical maneuvers to get back on the snow. And the best way to put it is like you're floating if you're on powder.
Yeah.
So it's a really strange sensation, but it's definitely the most fun thing I've ever done in my life. It's not really accessible in the United States because no mountains are really steep enough or really allow it. So this is pretty much a European thing at the moment.
So how are you getting up to the top? Are you hiking up there, or do you helicopter dropping you off?
No. There's a lift, and you just ski off piece.
Oh, okay.
That's cool. I'm really liking that. Mike and I have just gotten back into base jumping quite a bit, which is jumping off of objects like buildings and cliffs with parachutes. Mm-hmm. And Europe is a mecca for that as well. So basically, all the fun is we had in Europe, not so much Arizona.
Yeah, that's true.
It's basically why I just ended up living in Europe.
Yeah. Like,
if you travel enough, then anywhere is just a home base. So I just decided to put my home base closer to all the things that I see in my future rather than the things that I have right now.
I gotcha.
So yeah, the speed riding, I'm not doing that yet, but I hope to be doing that by the end of the year. And then I've been doing a fair bit of base jumping and still the other stuff. Paragliding is super rad. If no one's ever done that, that's super accessible compared to skydiving. You can go get a license for, you know, like $1,500, $2,000, and then buy gear for a similar amount, and you're in the sport for life, and you can go fly any day for free.
Yeah.
So that's pretty rad.
It's almost a little too accessible. Like, you show up at a well-known paragliding spot, you'll see pretty young athletic dudes, not saying that we fall into that category, maybe Mike does, but you'll see these like really fat, like 50-year-old guys that you can sort of start to arrive at this as like their first extreme sport.
Yeah.
You know, a life of, you know, sitting in the office or whatever, and then it's cool, but it's also pretty entertaining.
You're like,
also great crashes. So yeah, it's a, I think a lot of paragliders transition to skydiving.
Okay.
Starting that, so it's a good gateway sport for our sport.
Okay.
And vice versa.
Yeah, and vice versa.
How many jumps do you guys have now?
I have 3,500 because I don't do jumps.
Yeah, I've got 7,500.
Oh wow, okay.
Probably more than half of those are doing tandem jumps, which are Steven wants to go do a jump and he's never jumped before, you pay a skydiving place to have a guide essentially take you, attached to you, and do that.
Okay. Yeah. Damn, bro.
Super, it's crazy. Super cool thing to do if you've never skydived. If you are a full-time skydiver, it can be a little bit depressing after a while.
Big time.
especially if your students don't tip you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
That's super important.
If you tip your bar. Think about tipping the person that saved your life.
And if you tell them that in advance, it might do some flippy-doos and stuff for you and make a little bit more.
Hey, there you go. So there's some inside info.
If you throw up on them, mandatory $100.
Yeah, you've gotten thrown up. How many times have you been thrown up on?
Zero. I'm speaking for Jesse here.
Five?
Oh, for real?
Yeah. But those are pretty good odds, and, you know,
those are pretty good.
1,000.
Yeah.
Or so. Even more. I mean, I honestly have no idea how many I have, but it feels like a lot.
Yeah.
Averaging about 1,000 a year.
Okay.
But the thing about working full-time in the sport and doing that volume of jumping is, at the end of the day, you lead into the next day, you get kind of burnout off just sitting in an airplane.
Yeah.
Loud, just droning, plane.
Yeah.
So it's important to keep the mental game up and try to do something productive on the plane. Like, I started taking my phone and taking Duolingo and books and stuff behind the students' back that they can't see. Because you just spend so much time sitting on planes.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that's mainly what burns people out. It's just doing mindless waiting.
He's saying this right now, but the last 2 weeks that we've been jumping together, every time he's on the plane, he's playing like some motocross.
Yeah, that skills motocross too.
He wanted to sound smart and have Duolingo out.
This podcast is not sponsored by that game, but
we are actually. I got a shout out to my sponsor, Arch Jug. They pay us $500 an episode up in upstate New York. Arch Jug. They have the town's most okay pizza, and yeah, that's Arch Jug.
What's up with the Arch Jug? What kind of pizza?
This Italian pizza, baby. It's like it's an Italian restaurant in upstate New York. It's just a buddy of mine. I'm not really sponsored by them. I just like to call him out every day.
Okay.
Every episode.
what kind of crust are we talking?
He has all sorts of crust, man. It's good. It is good pizza. It's really good pizza. Family owned restaurant. Been in town for decades. So.
Oh, to more decades.
Yes. So, yeah. Arch joke, baby.
Living in Europe now, I've been having some authentic Italian pizza and. At the risk of sounding like an Indian American, I really love American pizza, particularly
New York.
Yeah, it's good.
Yes.
Especially the whole thing where they cut their pizza for you.
Yeah, that's nice.
They don't do that in Europe.
They don't cut it for you?
They just get a proper pie, and that's left up to you to figure it out.
Yeah, just start in the middle in a spiraling motion. go from the inside out. Yeah.
Just fold it like a cone.
Typically, I stick bite my the middle. Nose through pizza the center. And I try to bite a hole in it like a donut and then chew my way out.
They're like, quit ordering American shit, you bastards. Like,
they will cut it begrudgingly if you tell them to, but yeah, they always give you some attitude about it.
Have you ever eaten horse before?
No.
I was in Italy last summer doing some base jumping off of a really popular spot out there that's pretty safe, but relatively safe.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed with pizza as well, so...
Yeah.
Arch Jugs, is it?
Yeah, Arch Jugs.
Shout out to you guys. I had a pizza and there was some, I don't speak Italian, I can speak Spanish pretty okay, but in Italian there was a word that I didn't understand and the waitress was like, yes, it's a local meat. I'm like, okay, that sounds cool. I can down for some local meat. And yeah. I brought it out, I'm like, man, this is so salty and like tough, what is this? And my buddy's like, oh, it's horse. You're eating local horse. I'm like, oh, okay. Well.
Like, yay.
I'm into it.
Was it good?
Yeah, it was good. It was salty, but...
Was it really tough or what?
Yeah, it's pretty tough. Yeah. Not the top 4 or 5 toppings I would have on a pizza,
yeah.
Probably. But
horse on pizza, dude.
Maybe your buddies up in upstate New York might give that a whirl.
Yeah, dude. We can get some of those Amish people, get their horses, and we'll put that on there, dude. You just take them while they're sleeping. They can't catch us. They don't have cars.
Shout out to the Amish.
or parachutes.
Yep, or parachutes. So after Arizona, where are you guys heading after this? Or can you say where you're going?
Yeah. I'm heading up to Utah to do some speed flying, which is flying smallish parachutes down hills. They go fast and you stay close to the ground, which is pretty fun. And shoot a promotional video for one of my sponsors, Fluid Wings, which is going to be a good time. Excited. It's really nice people, and I'm stoked to hang out at the factory and see what they've got in the works.
Okay, that's where their factory is, so you'll be out there. And okay.
Yeah, it's a split production, so they have a research facility in DeLand, Florida, which is kind of like the American mecca of skydiving as far as the industry is mm-hmm. concerned. And then in Utah, they have a production facility. There's a lot of mountain sports that are done in Utah, so they had their roots in speed flying and paragliding and then transitioned into skydiving, so that's why part of their factory is located out there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dude, where are you going next?
Nothing too exciting. I mean, with the world being shut down.
Yeah.
But I'm finagling a way to get into the EU. a passport from another country that's completely legal. And I'm trying to get into the country so I can go back to Italy at
gotcha.
End of September and then go to Slovenia for an event that some of their skydivers are hosting where you're going to be flying down close to mountains with wingsuits and parachutes and stuff.
Okay.
Just for fun. But who knows? I'm still trying to figure out through Delta if I can get my passport number validated in time to go. So I'll have
gotcha.
To quarantine for X amount of months.
Months now.
2 weeks.
Okay, I was like, wait a minute.
But then, I mean, that's pretty much it. Go back to San Diego and work for the rest of the year, I guess.
Is that where you're usually jumping out of if you're...
I'm in northern here. San Diego.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Lots of surfing and skydiving and burritos.
Burritos.
It's as boring as that.
If you ever move to Europe, bring burritos with you.
Yeah. No burritos out there?
No burritos, really. No spicy food to speak of. Maybe some Thai food, but if you like Mexican food, Europe is not the place for you.
What's your favorite thing out there to eat?
Probably horse. No, I'm just kidding. I've never eaten horse. But my neighbors have horses, so maybe when I get back,
They're like, I don't know what happened to it. Just got a bite mark out of it.
My favorite thing out there. There's this local coffee shop. I don't know if you guys have ever had a thing called a Kinder Bueno.
Mm-mm. Chocolate.
Okay.
It's a great chocolate. It's starting to make a name in America now. But
yeah, they have them in like aisles of supermarkets now, like a checkout that's a red and white label.
What's it called?
Kinder
Bueno. Kinder is
Kinder like Bueno.
They're basically like Willy Wonka or whatever, but yeah, Kinder Bueno.
Good stuff.
Super good. Anyway, they have a Cafe Kinder Bueno. So it's like a big chocolatey coffee with whipped cream on top, and then a Kinder Bueno bar broken on the top, and like that with a thing called a Coco Ai, which is like a Coco Monsieur, but with pineapple on it, which is like, I guess, a ham and cheese sandwich with pineapple on it. I don't know. Anyway.
Dude, I want that.
Those two combined, breakfast of champions. It's my favorite thing.
I want that.
What's your breakfast of champions?
Good old Mickey D, Egg McMuffin, you know, like 2 for $4 or whatever they got.
Great value.
Oh, dude, I'm all about the value, bro.
Us too.
I didn't eat McDonald's for like maybe 10 years.
Oh.
I would say like 5 years.
Hold his pinky up.
But I moved to Europe and it's... kind of comforting, so
yeah.
I comfort food. I ate a bunch of McDonald's like when I was over there, and then right when I got back, I immediately stopped eating McDonald's again.
Yeah, because now you can have it.
Still haven't had McDonald's in the U.S. in at least 5 years.
Oh, dude, nice.
I've had it like maybe 15 times in the last 4 months in Europe.
I assure you, I've eaten enough for both of us.
When I first moved to Southern California, I told myself I was never going to eat Taco Bell again because I grew up with that as my guilty pleasure.
Yeah, yeah.
Then that damn grilled cheese burrito came out and just turned my world upside down. So now I'm frequenting Taco Bell in SoCal, which is a travesty.
Yeah, right. Everyone looks at you like, what is he doing? So your wingsuiting, you guys just got into wingsuiting recently? Or because I hadn't seen anything you guys doing that until...
The past 6 months for me, six or seven months, I think.
Yeah, about the same for me. I'm pretty bad at it.
We're both pretty bad at it. It's the blind leading the blind.
Yeah.
We're a danger to ourselves and those around us, so we only pretty much jump at each other or one or two other people to keep the group small. So there are less variables in the skydive. Like, if there's only Mike and I, I'm only going to crash into Mike.
Yeah.
I'm going to crash into Mike and Steven and whoever else is there.
You're way less likely to crash into me, period, because we're going to be looking at each other the whole time. So.
Yeah.
So even with all your experience, it's still a pretty big learning curve for...
Yeah, for now. I think it will get better, but it's just in these elementary stages, we're just trying to figure out how to incorporate basically flying a parachute on your body.
Yeah.
Which is a weird thing to put into the air.
Yeah.
We're used to having it over our head, and now that it's between our armpits and our legs, it's a super foreign sensation.
I bet.
Yeah, it's really disconcerting. It's literally like flying in a straitjacket. Like, you can't lift your arms over your head. So if you deploy a parachute and have a malfunction or something, like, there's a whole added factor there.
Oh, yeah, I guess, yeah.
So it's pretty unnerving, and then you're kind of like, it's like someone chopped your legs off and gave you new legs, but they're 10 times as long now. You know, like, you're really learning how to use your body in a whole new way. Like, me and Jesse are both relative experts in, like, the same type of flying, but without a suit on. Like, you can still move around and zoom around like fighter jets without a suit on. It's just way more powerful and lasts way longer if you're wearing suits.
Yeah.
And it's funny because, yeah, like, as good as we are, like, it's one of the things we do. We travel around and coach that type of flying. But then throwing a suit on, like, total beginners, total dangers. Like, you have to have, but we're having a lot of respect for it, and we're training really hard. And, you know, I think we both got goals with where we want to take that in the future. And I think we, you know, need to take it seriously in order to make sure that we can achieve those goals safely.
Are you doing any base wingsuiting yet, or no?
That's the plan. I've done, and Mike has done jumps off cliffs that you reach terminal velocity, but they're in much smaller suits that look like track suits.
Yeah, yeah,
that
okay.
Pressurize and kind of make you look like the Marshmallow Man. You get less of a glide, but it's more effective than just going in street clothes.
Gotcha.
So we're kind of going up and graduating from, you know, having just regular clothes to those suits, and then hopefully soon those suits to wingsuits.
Gotcha.
Also, right now we're driving like the, you know, like the Volvo.
Yeah.
And then after that we might get like the BMW, and then after that we might get like the Ferrari.
Yeah.
But, like, yeah.
Also, don't recommend wingsuit flying in Arizona in July.
Because all the dust devils and crap.
No, just because we're like, they're sweatsuits. If you touch these materials, they're like nylon, you know? So we're sitting on the plane the other day, and it's 103 degrees outside, and just even our bodies being an inch from each other, we're just radiating heat off each other, sweating, and these suits are filling up with sweat, and it's like, definitely more of a winter discipline for skydiving than summer.
Keep in mind that, like, people have landed these suits in piles of boxes without a parachute.
Yeah, that's
true. They're very effective, right? Like, and they're very effective because they don't let any air through them, so they become a wing.
Yeah.
And they do that by not letting any air through them. So when you're sitting on a 120 degree airplane with other people literally on top of you, it's brutal.
Yeah, if you're trying to drop weight for wrestling, it's probably a backup wingsuit.
Damn. Form.
It's probably a little more effective than jogging in a garbage bag, to be honest.
Dude, yeah, it's so stupid hot here because, I mean, I just came from New York and it's like 80, 75 there. And here it's like stepping into a freaking oven, dude.
Yeah.
There's no humidity. It's just blast you right in the face.
Yeah, we've been hanging out at the pool the past couple days and just getting absolutely destroyed by the sun.
Yeah, yeah.
But,
yeah, I got a pretty bad sunburn for the first time this year. I moved to Belgium in February right before COVID, so not only was I in a place that's more north than Canada, but it was a lockdown, so I had no reason to go outside, really. So I was basically a ghost when I showed up. And then I decided to go tan at the pool for an hour without sunscreen.
And then just burnt, baby.
Yep.
Burn them up.
Not the most intelligent decision.
So do you have like a certain amount of jumps or a certain place where you think you'll be proficient enough to really start doing some like base wingsuiting or
I think it's just
like with the Cadillac? Or so, whatever he said.
Hopefully more like a Tesla than a Cadillac.
Yeah.
Yeah, futuristic.
Yeah.
They're just going to sex of wingsuit.
Yeah, it's just going to fly itself and you don't have to do anything. You just pop up vertical on your feet and land like a SpaceX rocket.
Dude.
That's what we're going to be doing.
That would be sweet. How cool would that? Like Iron Man.
It is happening right now. There's like two or three people on the planet that are doing it. But yeah, they have invented these very... probably a little bit sketchy, but really expensive contraptions where you can now take off from ground level, go fly around the city for a while because it's jet propelled, and then go land without a parachute. I don't know if they've landed without the parachute yet.
I think it's in development, but there's no video out yet.
Yeah, I mean it's dicey, but it's pretty rad. Yeah, to answer your question, like. Maybe there's a jump number thing involved. Like, I'd like to have, at minimum, like a couple hundred wingsuit jumps before I get there. And right now, I'm probably flirting with like 40.
Okay, so you guys are just getting into it.
Yeah,
I gotcha.
We're brand new.
What made you want to kind of get into that? We're kind of just getting bored of everything else, or just want to add to your.
Pretty much.
It's kind of like the equivalent of, just getting bored of everything else. It's kind of like people who've never skydived before sitting at home during quarantine on Instagram and, you know, people are awesome and whatever these pages are, they're promoting action sports and they're like, man, I want to do a skydive, so they come and do a tandem. Right now, Mike and I, or at least for me, sitting in quarantine, super bored with skydiving. Well, not super bored, but wanting something fresh and seeing all these guys just ripping down mountains
in
wingsuits and going like nose to nose with goats.
Yeah.
Like, man, I want to do that. Why are those guys going to have all the fun? Like, that looks so amazing.
Yeah.
Because they worked really hard for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's like, that's why I started allocating a lot more time and money into that.
It's a little bit more complicated for me too because I, for a really long time, said I never wanted to do that. And I still really, you know, like deeply acknowledge like all the negative sides of, you know, that part of the sport. Like a lot of bad stuff happens, but
yeah.
It took a lot for me to get over, you know, that concern. And the thing that pushed me over the edge was like seeing a vision for like better ways to, you know, explore the world, like better ways to bring images to a screen that, you know, people would want to watch. Like my big passion in life right now really is filmmaking. And I think like being able to make those films and not just like, you know, about the sports side of it. Like I don't really care about somebody flying the next tightest line or like anything like that. I mean, you can get as close as you want until you hit the cliff. And then you
yeah,
die.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily...
you die quickly.
Yeah, quickly.
If you're lucky. It's not necessarily, like, the coolest thing. It's just, like...
So you're more interested in the people behind it
exactly.
all.
And there's so many cool stories and so much to learn from a lifestyle lived that way.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think that, like, I will have the capability to do that. I know that, you know, me and Jesse both have the... like the talent because we've made it in other parts of the sport.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that we're qualified already. That's a very different thing, but it means that if we work really hard, I have no doubt that we can succeed there.
Yeah.
It's like when Mike, not maybe Mike is more like Michael Jordan, I've got the same name, but like Michael Jordan tries to play baseball after basketball.
Yeah.
You know, like he was okay at it, but it's not the same thing.
Yeah.
He wasn't, you know, sinking threes from home plate.
Yeah.
That's a really good point about like the community. Like when you're at a skydiving operation, like somewhere you pay money to get on a plane, drop zone, you're basically sitting in a high school cafeteria.
Yeah, that's like, true. That's like, true.
Kind of popularity contest, people buzzing around, kind of like gossiping about this and that. And just a lot of buzzing, a lot of noise.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just a lot of like, look at me, you know.
Virtue signaling.
Yeah. But yeah, definitely. And like, you know, girls there and guys, you know, spreading their peacock feathers and stuff, like whatever. But when you go base jumping or speed flying or these more environmental centric sports,
gotcha,
you're out there with who you want to be out there mm-hmm. with, you know, like I'm responsible for you, you're responsible for Mike if something happens. So it's a very tailored crew that you're with,
more of a brotherhood type of
trust them.
Yeah,
especially with like base jumping. You're usually jumping in pretty remote areas if you're jumping off cliffs and stuff. And,
yeah.
You know, let's say Jesse has a issue and breaks his leg. Well, now Steven and Mike are responsible for getting me 60 miles to the nearest hospital. You know?
Yeah.
So that kind of trust in that group of people that you hand select and who also hand select to do, I think is a really rewarding social aspect of it.
Yeah.
Like you're just out there in the elements with who you want to be out there mm-hmm. with. And that opens up a lot of really cool stuff.
Yeah, especially if you're putting yourself out there like that and you're making these bonds and doing things that normal people aren't doing with people, you create that bond that, you know, can never be broken. It's like the military, you know, you go through something crazy like that, you know, going through war, and you'll always have that bond with that person. You know, there's guys I still talk to all the time that, you know, it's been 10 years since I deployed. So
for sure, I feel more connected to people that I've met in passing in skydiving, or, well, you know, maybe less in skydiving because it is really accessible and there are a lot of transient people, but even in the short amount of time I've spent base jumping and really any of the mountain sports, like I feel way more connected to those people in the long term than yeah. anybody I met in high school, you know what I mean, like
mm-hmm.
with the exception of like five good friends.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, yeah, you're right, like they're, when you share an experience that requires that level of trust,
yeah, yeah,
you at least have a really good ground to start on as mm-hmm. far as like you know, a friendship and a trust with that person. And then if you find those people where it's more than that, like, man, it's so good. Like,
yeah.
The best friends I've ever made are from doing these things that are completely new, probably to both of us.
Exactly.
And finding a safe way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I have the most respect and learn the most about people is, like, what do people become when you put them in a really sketchy situation?
Yeah, true.
And
yeah.
you force them to act, like...
Yeah, I think fear makes people really... it shows their true colors. You
yeah.
become really vulnerable and you become an open book.
Yeah.
And if you can... expose yourself emotionally like that to other people and they accept it when you're out there and you guys have a successful jump or whatever, you get to the bottom, you're like, man, that was insane.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I can't believe we just did that. And you just don't forget those moments with that people and they know what it was like to be the same open book
mm-hmm.
As you were, you know, you're about to jump off a cliff or do whatever and you're scared.
Yeah.
And those people are scared around you and you're trying to keep each other confident and stuff. And that's really binding.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, I had one of those moments really recently. So I think about this a lot. Like, I really like watching people do something that they're scared of for the first time.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's too good. It's delicious.
Yeah.
But it's not like an ego thing. It's not because, like, I feel superior to them because
yeah.
I've already done it and now I'm get to chill and watch them do it. And, like, ha ha ha. It's I like feeling that emotion that they're feeling. Like, I'm very empathetic with them and mm-hmm. I like being connected to that. Like, it's interesting to feel like their fear and watch them overcome it. It's like
it'll unlock something in them too.
Yeah, and so by doing that, it reminds you of what, you know, you went through.
Yeah.
And what that did for you, and it helps you keep pushing forward and stay inspired. So, like recently, I did my first not terminal per se based jump. I guess terminal being like you reach the fastest speed that you would reach in free fall, which requires a lot of height. Big wall base jump, you know, like upwards of 1200 feet. And, it was with one of my best friends, and, I got to watch him have that experience with me.
He was
probably more stoked on my jump than I was. Cause he's standing there on the exit point, and it had rained like the day before. So just that particular exit point that we were at, you know, like you do this rope rappel like 20 feet into this little nook, like this little ledge that is the good place to jump off of. The ropes were like super slick this day. And like I've done a lot of climbing in my life, so I'm comfortable on ropes.
Being exposed.
And, like, having like 3 points of contact and getting myself around on rocks.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was peaking, you know, like it, and the ropes were slick, and we didn't have any safety gear, like idiots. We had them at the house.
Yeah.
I just didn't know that we needed them.
What kind of safety gear, like descenders and stuff?
Yeah, just like a harness and a blade device, you know, like something that you could easily hike with that weighs nothing, and then you could just put under your harness or in your stash bag or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm digressing. Like, so you have to do this pretty sketchy, slick descent into this little rock face, and then, you know, the rock's mostly facing downhill, and like, you know, at this point it's like a minor waterfall. Like,
yeah,
a little bit of water running from it, just from like water draining off the top of the mountain. And my exit area was like maybe like half the size of a placemat. You know, like that's like the good level spot to push off of, and was also wet. So like I took a 20 foot rope descent on slick ropes, put gear on, and then put like, you know, like descended a little bit further to this little like tiny like placemat. Maybe like, we'll just say, call it an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper.
Yeah.
Both my feet just couldn't quite fit on it together.
Damn.
You know, and my buddy's like a couple feet over on a different ledge, and he's like filming me with a cell phone. And like, I didn't know at the time, like I was trying to keep my cool. I knew I was freaking out, like functioning, but like
the max, shit in your pants.
Yeah, like, it's the max amount of fear that I've felt since maybe my first skydive. Like,
yeah.
Like really like knee shaking, my legs felt weak. Like my mind was still working. I felt comfortable doing the jump. And like, I think that's really important to recognize
when you're
too scared to function. But I was there, but my body was like, you know, really rebelling against this thing that I was trying to push it through. And I made the jump, and you know, when I landed, like my buddy like lands after me and like shows me the video, and we're like hugging and shit, and he's like, dude, look at your legs shaking. And like like he's like, dude, I was just like, that was like the coolest thing. Like going through that moment together and like taking a picture on the, like, you know, together on the bottom of that mountain, and like, you know, doing this thing that I'd wanted to do since I started skydiving like back in 2012, like,
yeah,
and then accomplishing that with someone that I genuinely love was like, you know, like those are the experiences that make all this stuff worth it,
dude. Fucking A.
But, man, it was pretty scary.
Butt puckering, dude.
Also, something that's really selfish of me to say, but for like traveling and getting to do a lot of these like action sports stuff, you could be, you know, let's say he was in Switzerland. You can be in Switzerland for 2 hours and see a visual that someone who's lived there for 60 years has never seen before.
Yeah, that's true.
It's a weird, selfish, but really cool, intimate thing to get to keep for yourself.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, there's a lot of beauty, like, just beyond the edge of, like, people's
comfort.
Yeah. Like, it's maybe a silly bumper sticker, but, like,
yeah,
you know,
for real.
You go somewhere and you, I guess, yeah, just the, like if you go to the coolest beach in the world and then you go there every day, that beach is going to be pretty lame.
Yeah.
You jump a fence and then go to a different one and there's something different about it that you've never seen before. Like, now that's stunning. And this particular valley in Switzerland, like, is one of the coolest places I've ever seen. It's just like more than 1,000 foot cliffs on either side with waterfalls running down and rainbows in the middle of the day and like just a tiny farm town in between. Like, Dude, it's like...
Yeah, I've seen videos of that, and dude, that place is sick. Like, I want to just go see it.
Like, if I wasn't a base jumper, I would still be going.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the coolest place. It's so beautiful.
See, with jumping for me, it was something that I never wanted to do ever. I was so close-minded to it. I was like, why the hell would I want to do that? And my friend convinced me to do a tandem.
Who was that? Travis?
No, another guy before that. I think it was before I was joined the military, right after I got out of the military. And it was in upstate New York. I forgot what drop zone it was. And then when I moved to South Carolina, I found Walterboro that was close by. And, you know, after that first tandem jump I did, I was like, I want to do this. I want to get my license. And I was, you know, I thought about it. I'm like, dude, I was so close-minded to that. And it was something that I ended up loving and had, you know, my preconceived notion of what it would feel like, what it would be like, was totally different. And I'm like, what else am I shutting my brain down? Yeah, because I'm either scared or I don't, you know. So it really made me open my mind, you know, and start looking at things like, dude, just because you're scared of something doesn't mean it's something you necessarily need to stay away from. Like, being uncomfortable is growth.
That's a really good point. And there's like, without sounding too... cliche, there's like a point with jumping or like in base jumping, whatever. I think maybe we used to feel a lot more out of airplanes, but now our attention is focused to cliffs and stuff, of just preparation, like silence and then acceptance and then go sort of thing.
Yeah.
And that very sensation can be transferred to a lot of different things in life, like whether you're about to like kiss a girl for the first time, eat something that's moving, you know, like it's an alleyway in China or whatever.
Started this whole thing.
We've been eating bats long before this thing popped off. But I think it's a really nice transferable skill that can be acquired through doing stuff that scares you, particularly jumping out of things.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that acceptance thing is like...
it's weird. I can't really put a finger on it. It's a weird thing.
So a good way to describe it, I think, is like... I think me and Jesse's first real job in skydiving was filming tandems. First time skydivers. There's almost every single one of them has this moment where, like, right before they leave the airplane, they're holding on really tight.
Yeah.
They're like, not just physically, but like mentally, rooted in not getting out of that airplane, even as they're willing their bodies to go out of the airplane.
Because they paid for it.
Yeah, that was me on my tandem holding the door.
Like, the last thing they want to do subconsciously is get out of that airplane. But then, and it's like the face of fear. Like, if you wrote fear in the dictionary and then you put a picture next to it, it would be that.
Yeah, that's true.
And then as soon as they get out of the plane, there's like, it's less than 2 or 3 seconds. The next time you see their face, it's like huge smile.
Not the best thing ever.
Like, this person that was just terrified all of a sudden is so stoked and doesn't have a care in the world. And, you know, like, how does that happen? And I think Jesse nailed it. It's that acceptance. And then I think the big change between that process when I started skydiving and then, or when I start, you know, like my first base jumps or whatever, or my first terminal base jumps, like it just keeps going, like however you want to, whatever skill you're trying to tackle or
there's always endeavor. Something new.
The big difference between the beginning and then, you know, how I feel now is like that acceptance just comes earlier and earlier. Like, even getting like, you know, ready for competition, right? Like, you get so amped up, right? And then like sometimes you can take all that energy into a competition and you do really badly.
I see it happen a lot.
Yeah,
people set these expectations to themselves and they just overwhelm them, you know?
And it can be the same in,
instead of being in the moment, they're thinking about what's gonna happen or
just taking that energy. Raw fucking, sorry. Raw.
No, you're good.
Okay, I'm not allowed to curse.
Yeah, you can curse.
Floodgates open.
I've seen a lot in competition, and I maybe not so much in base jumping because I think it's a very different community from skydiving, even though it's a similar sport. But people set expectations for themselves in the competition environment. Like, there's one person that comes to mind who spends a lot of money training stuff and is expecting a certain result and wants to make a certain team to go to a world competition.
Yeah.
And then just blows it. And halfway through the competition, there's a point where if they do a little bit better, they can maybe still make the team, you know? And I think that gets in their head because they vocalize that to me. And it's like, well, if I don't do this, then this. If I don't do X, then Y. And that can really be to some people's demise.
Yeah.
And I think that that could be transferable to other action sports, but most of people's actions, people who are at the top of their game, don't really have that as much, maybe?
Yeah, I think that's kind of getting onto what I was about to say, which is like the difference between my first time doing those things and then, you know, now when I feel like confident and successful with something, is just that that moment of acceptance happens much earlier now.
Yeah.
You know, like I still go through all the same stress before competitions, before, you know, like big dangerous moments.
Yeah.
Like, man, this stuff is dangerous no matter how much you want
yeah.
to.
Yeah.
Like it's not. And especially when you start pushing it, like doing the unorthodox stuff and stuff that maybe people haven't really done before, or
yeah.
haven't done at all, or there's no literature on it, or no one to tell you how to do it. Like, you go through all that stress, but then you have to acknowledge when you've done all the preparation you can do, and then you accept.
Yeah.
Once I found that moment of acceptance, like, I perform a lot better. It was the same way, you know, back to when I was like a high school cross country runner, track runner, you know, like, I'll just get amped up before races, and there's nothing you can do. It's not skill based at all. Like, just, my body is going to have shown up feeling exactly how it's going to feel, and the only factor as to whether or not I'm going to do well is, you know, like, the work's been done. Like, it's
yeah.
just whether or not I want to feel the pain. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's kind of like that in skydiving, except hopefully without the pain.
Yeah, yeah.
The work's been done. I've prepared. I just have to have faith that my skills are going to be there when I need them.
Yeah, and that's where, you know, like you said, the preparation comes into play, where you feel comfortable enough knowing, hey, did I do enough to prepare myself for this moment, you know?
Sure. The harder I work, the luckier I
get. Yep, yeah, that's very true.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So, dudes, what else you got here?
What else you got?
I don't know. Shit.
Put us on the spot.
I'm putting you on the spot, dude.
Well,
I don't know.
Yeah, the.
I know, he's like, man, I gotta think.
Or websites on my phone that'll maybe spark something.
So, yeah, if for anyone who's interested in following these guys and seeing what they're doing, again, Jesse Weyher, it's at JesseWeyher on Instagram. And then Mike Brewer is Mike, MIKE ____
yeah.
Brewer, BREWER. Follow these guys, dude. They're always doing cool stuff. They're all over the place. It's pretty inspiring to see where they were and how far they've come. It's been a wild journey. I've been, you know, watching you guys from when we started to, you know, all your whole Myrtle Beach fiasco.
Been
to,
a long time.
Yeah.
Better part of a decade.
Yep.
If you want another place to find some cool content, my team has a page called Kinetic_Limitless.
Okay.
And that's really where the...
Is there a Kinetic Limitless without the underscore?
Yep.
Oh, dang. Yeah, he's getting all the underscore names.
There's actually just a Kinetic, and it's a fake account, and I'm working on busting it. So.
Nice. And I'll post all these stuff in the link, too, if you guys have anything you want me to plug or, like, your sponsors or anything. I'll put them in there.
Alberto's Tacos on Mission Boulevard in Oceanside, California.
Ooh, okay.
Get the Cali. There's no sponsorship here. I just really like that burrito.
I need to go get that then before I get out of here.
Yeah, that page is basically going to be the channel where all the stuff I was talking about with, like, the filmmaking, and, like, maybe we didn't talk about that at all, but there's a group of people, you know, like we were talking about earlier, the people who I trust and have been through
yeah.
stuff with. And
so that's your Kinetic Limitless page, is that group? Okay,
yeah,
gotcha.
That group, and, you know, they're all experts in what they do, and, you know, the goal is to, the whole group began by making a promise to each other that we would spend a dedicated amount of time per year getting together and doing things that we wanted to do, which means not waiting for work, not waiting for
yeah.
stuff, but sometimes just
hasn't happened this year yet.
Oh, COVID.
So is it all jumpers, or is it people from different, you know?
It's a little bit of everything. Most of it's air sports related.
Okay.
It's not all skydiving. You know, like, it can be some surfing or, like, the speed flying, wings with strings, like that
okay.
whole realm. And, yeah, just a little bit of everything, but it's all pretty cool. And anyway, the goal is to get together a few times a year and, like, cherish our friendship, but also, like, push our skills and our creativity. And that's where we're pushing from here. And Jesse's right. It hasn't happened yet this year because COVID. So
is it more of, like, a production page? Like, or is it...
It's a mix between a production, you know, like we do have a team that performs and we have projects.
Okay, gotcha.
But it's also a community because
we... Stunts and lifestyle?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both.
Okay.
You know, there's like everything that we've been talking about is all possible for anybody.
Yeah.
All this stuff is like, it depends how much like time and effort and in some cases money, but like over the course of time that you want to throw at it. And
and keep pushing at it. It's honestly
airline tickets and toys.
Yeah. I mean, because before you guys started jumping, did you ever think like, hey, I'm going to be a crazy skydiver in the future? Was that ever in your mind and your plan?
No,
I didn't know. First of all, I didn't even know that skydiving was a thing.
Yeah.
As no one does.
Yeah. And then
that brings us back to the spectator sport.
Yeah.
We're super tied into action sports before, you know, skydiving. We had no idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like skydiving and bungee jumping were the same. Like, it's just a thing that you did.
Maybe yeah.
If you really liked it, you did it twice.
Yeah.
I didn't think there were people that did it, you know, for a lifetime.
Yeah.
Thousands and thousands of times and, you know, like pushed limits and created new outlets for creativity. I mean, it's a really cool sport.
Yeah.
It's a bummer that no one's really ever going to watch it, which is fine. I mean,
it keeps it for us.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's all good.
You have to, it's like, you know, I think Miles Dasher said it really well. He's a pretty like well-known base jumper, but he's like, it applies to base jumping and I think it applies to skydiving too, but it's like base jumping is not a sport that finds you, you know, like you have to work.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's one of the cool things about skydiving too. Like, you don't have to work as hard as you have to work for base jumping, but it kind of keeps the community, like, there's an element there will always be like-minded people, even if they all disagree and are really politically incorrect a lot.
For sure. I mean, for better or for worse, it's not quite your pick up a skateboard that your parents just buy you for Christmas and go out in the driveway and learn a kickflip.
Yeah.
You know? Like, it's just so much more of that. So.
It's an investment.
Yeah, it is. It's not, really not a four-man sport, but
yeah.
We don't have any money.
Because it all goes back. So how would you, for someone who doesn't have a lot of money and they're interested in starting, you know, that journey, I guess, what would be your first bit of advice for somebody trying to get into the sport? Go whatever else easiest.
I would say show up at a skydiving center, like a drop zone, and just submerge yourself, whatever.
Yeah.
Be around these people for a weekend or so and have a beer with them, whatever, and chew the fat with them, talk to them and see
yeah.
what they think.
Yeah.
Everybody's different. Some people go the route of trying to work in the sport immediately via packing tandem parachutes, stuff like that, and they can scrap up enough money to get into it. But it's a difficult difficult entry. There's a pretty big entry cost to get into it.
Yeah.
It's not cheap. Aviation isn't cheap. You know, every time a plane fills up with fuel, it's couple hundred dollars.
Yeah.
So
I mean, it's like most planes are like $600 an hour to run.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's not cheap.
Not to mention, you know, what they cost to maintain.
But I don't know. I would say just don't go to the bars. You can't now anyways, COVID. So just keep your stimulus check and your unemployment in your back pocket for a rainy day when you want to start skydiving.
Yeah. Just keep in mind once you start jumping, like, and you're in, like $25 to $30 a jump is pretty normal. So most people I know spend more money than that at the bar multiple times per week.
Yeah,
so
that's very true.
Even people that don't have money, they have money.
Yeah.
Like, and yeah, I was, you know, my answer is going to be like a two-step process. Like, one, go to the drop zone and find a way to get a job as a packer. And then two, quit packing as soon as possible. Like, get the job, you know, get your license. And then packing is easy money, but you will spend all of your time
packing
on a pack yeah. and you will not be skydiving. So.
Yeah. We never did it, fortunately. But
I did it for 2 weeks.
Okay.
I've never done rough, it. Rough days. But,
there's this kid, I shouldn't say kid because I'm 28, he's only 19, but there's a dude who's younger than me who works at the drop zone that I work for as a packer, and he just started jumping. He has about 25 jumps. No, it can't be right. He's got more than that at this point, but he's packing upwards of 60 or 70 really big parachutes a day in the heat, and it's grueling work.
Yeah.
And whenever he gets opportunity to go jump by himself and grab his gear and hop up on a load between all of his vigorous work, he does it.
Yeah.
Like, man, like, aren't you getting tired? You know, like, why don't you just sit this one out? But I remember, like, with the empathy thing comes back into play. Like, I remember exactly how hungry I was when I was in his situation. So
you're like, I need to get up there. I need to get up there.
The hustle is still alive.
Yeah, and if you want to make it out of the packing mat, that's the only way to do it. Like, you have to jump a lot because, you know, the next step would probably be becoming a coach, which, like we were talking about earlier, is basically like a joke rating. Not to say that skydiving coaches, because that's a different thing. Like, not the rating, but like the people who do it professionally are very good. And
yeah.
Huge investment of time and skill and whatever. But like the USPA coach rating, you know, it's basically a license.
United States Parachute Association.
Yeah, so that's our governing body in America. That rating is basically a license to watch people do stuff and maybe debrief them afterwards and give them questionable intel on how to proceed. So like, yeah, that's something you, some drop zones you get paid to do. So like you get off the packing mat, then you're jumping, and you get more jumps, then you become a, you know, an AFF instructor, which is like the free fall instructors you can teach first jump courses. And then, you know, once you're in there and you're doing tandems or whatever, like you have a pretty solid ground to stand on. But the biggest thing, I think, you know, the biggest pitfall that I see people make is they get those jobs and then they get really used to not spending money or not jumping for themselves. And it's a really unfulfilling career. It's a really good way to burn out within 2 years.
Yeah.
So, I've been at it for 7 now. I'm still going strong.
I've burned out of 3 times. I keep managing to find a way to change it up.
Yeah, like finding new stuff like wingsuit.
Yeah.
But I would say the right way to do it is to have a job that actually
pays you well and
good amount of money, and then take that money and invest it into skydiving for yourself and not trying to pursue it professionally, and I think you'll have a lot better time than
going
into making your passion your job.
So yeah,
like sometimes I'll be saying the drop zone on my 11th tandem jump of the day and I see my friend rolling in his Tesla and come out with his brand new gear and kind of hops on a jump and then chills and eats a burrito and has a coffee
and then leaves.
Like 4 planes later he'll do another jump and I'm just kind of sitting there like,
I choose right?
And then I don't regret any of it, but I think a leisure role in skydiving is like a hobby versus a profession. It might be a little bit more fun and less financial stress.
Yeah, it's always.
I'm loving it.
For sure.
I'm loving it. You can't give McDonald's plugs. You're not eating it. Well, dudes, I just want to say thanks for doing this. That's pretty much it for me. I mean,
yeah, thanks for having
me. Like you said, I was here. I had to come. Yeah. I saw. I was like, oh crap, they're in Arizona. Where are you? Ah. So, but yeah, guys, again, Jesse Verhorstein, Gerger Vision, and Mike Brewer, Steen. But
there for good measure.
Yeah.
Steven, is your last name Duffney or did your wife make you take her name?
Shit, I should take her name. It's cooler, cooler than mine. Cooler.
That's it?
Cooler is her last name. I know, right? I'm like, dude, I sit down to pee anyway, so.
Your middle name, you should change your last name from Duffney to Duff, and then last name Cooler.
Stephen Duff Cooler, yeah. She gets mad when I sit down to pee, though, all the time, dude. Like, she's like, why are you sitting to pee? You're a boy.
She doesn't have to worry about you putting the seat up.
I know, right? See, I'm just being...
Mike when we share bathrooms.
Thanks, bud.
Dude, when you're a dad, like, that's your only time to yourself. So you're sitting in there as long as you can.
Matt skills motocross, too. So taking a beat.
It's all about scrolling Instagram.
All right, guys, that's it. And as always, duck off.